Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the panic on Wall Street as the Dow plunges across the board, while U.S. crude oil prices sank 6.6% due to the supply glut on global markets. One of the most quoted analysts on energy issues, Fadel Geit, joins us. He is the Managing Director of Oil and Gas Research with Oppenheimer & Company, and we will discuss the Saudi strategy of flooding the market to drive down the price of oil in order to undercut the shale oil boom in the U.S. and elsewhere and make it uneconomical to frack. While this strategy does not appear to be working, we'll examine the impact of lower oil prices on Russia and Venezuela and assess how much lower they can go now that Iran is beginning to sell its oil following the recent lifting of sanctions. Then we'll speak with Adele Stan, a Washington-based journalist who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics and is currently a weekly columnist for The American Prospect. We'll discuss the boost to Donald Trump's efforts to court the religious right in Iowa at Ted Cruz's expense, with the reappearance of Sarah Palin on the political stage alongside her fellow reality TV star. Having endorsed Trump yesterday, she praised him today before the rapturous Christian students at Oral Roberts University, who applauded wildly when the former Republican vice presidential nominee praised Donald Trump as a commander-in-chief who will kick ISIS's ass. Then, with President Obama visiting the Detroit Auto Show today, along with addressing the toxic water crisis in nearby Flint, Michigan, and Detroit's crumbling underfunded public schools, we'll speak with the automotive columnist for The Wall Street Journal, Dan Neal. He joins us to discuss the future of electric and hybrid cars that the president touted today by checking out Chrysler's new hybrid Pacifica minivan, as well as the all-electric affordable 2017 Chevy Bolt, that has a 200-mile range. And joining us now is Fadel Geit, who is Managing Director for Oil and Gas Research with Oppenheimer & Company in New York City. Mr. Geit has more than 36 years of experience in oil and gas research and has previously been with Mobil Oil and J.P. Morgan Company in New York. He is one of the most quoted analysts on energy issues and has testified before the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives about oil price speculation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Fadel Geit.
Thank you.
And Wall Street is in shock. It's hemorrhaging. The Dow is hemorrhaging. And it's all apparently about oil prices. So where is the bottom in oil prices?
Well, a couple of things. This is the symptoms, not the cause. I mean, low oil prices did not create the havoc on Wall Street. The fact of the matter is that throughout history, lower oil prices would be good for the economy because it improved consumer spending and consumer confidence. 70% of the economy is driven by the consumer, and obviously lower oil and energy costs in general, that means more disposable income, and that's good for the economy. But now, the market gurus are telling us that the reason that the stock market, the global stock market, is not doing too well is because oil prices are low. And that is new to me, for somebody who's been in the business for the last 30-plus years, to see that. But their idea is that that is an indication that the global economy is slowing down. So the demand for oil is not as robust as expected, and therefore we created the situation of oversupply.
But my understanding is that the situation of oversupply is not so much slowing demand, although slowing demand in China apparently is a factor. Surely the fact that the Saudis made the decision to glut the market in order to drive the fracas and the U.S. rise in production out of the market. And now you've got Iran coming on. And they're going to be pumping furiously because their sanctions have just been lifted. So how much is this is about the politics in the Middle East?
It's all about politics. Geopolitics has been and continues to be a driving force behind oil prices, in addition to speculation, in addition to the weakness or the strengths of the U.S. Currency and so forth. But let's go to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the largest oil exporting country in the world, exporting about 7 million barrels. They consume about 3 or 4 million barrels in the country, and the rest is exported. Saudi Arabia, for the first time in many years, refused to assume its traditional role of being a swing producer. Basically, when oil prices heat up, they put more oil on the market, they cool the market off, prices come down, and vice versa, when oil prices collapse, they take some of the crude off the market and that balance the market supply and demand and put crude oil prices higher. This time around, they came to OPEC saying the only way we're going to cut production is not going to be unilaterally like in the past. Everybody has to share the pain. Everybody has to cut production by 5 or 10%. This is the only way that we're going to get oil prices up. But since half of OPEC producers right now are not even fulfilling their own production quotas, they refuse the Saudi proposal. And I can see their point, whether it's Iran or Libya or Algeria or Nigeria or Venezuela, all these countries are producing less than what OPEC has allowed them to put out on the market because they didn't have the capital. They didn't have the know-how, and basically they are spending beyond their means. So Saudi Arabia stuck to its gun and said it is going to be market share and will depend on market share. So by doing so, they flooded the market and created the oversupply situation. But the intention was, or the target for the strategy, was basically to punish both Iran and Russia for what they are doing in the Middle East, or at least what the Saudis think that they are doing in the Middle East, as well as curb shale production growth in the U.S. The bad news here for the Saudis and for OPEC is that shale is here to stay. It's a new technology. The shale revolution in the U.S. has, in my view, changed the global oil market forever. We are not going to go back to where we were 5 years ago or 10 years ago. U.S. shale production averaged 4.5 million barrels per day last year. Despite the 40% capital spending cut, shale production proved to be very resilient and only dropped by a couple of 100,000 barrels per day. 4% drop in production, that is as a result of 40% drop in investment and in capital spending. It's because the industry and the companies have become more efficient, and they cut costs, they reduce operating expenses, so they had to do whatever it takes to survive. And so their break-even point continues to decline, and that means that it will be resilient to lower oil prices a lot longer than what OPEC thinks. Having said that, yes, production at the end of the day, OPEC, at least the Saudi strategy, will curb production growth in shale production growth. It's not going to totally kill production, but it will cool off the double-digit production growth that we have enjoyed in this country for the last 5 years.
So what does this say about the strategy of the Saudis then and where it stands now? Are they rethinking it? I know there's some political turmoil going on in the kingdom where the king himself, so there's some doubts about his mental acuity. He may have Alzheimer's. He's relying almost entirely upon his 30-year-old son, who's really running the kingdom. He's taken on the oil portfolio as well as the defense ministry. Apparently, there are rumors now of succession crisis going on within the Saudi Al Saud ruling family, where the king is going to skip over Mohammed Nayef, who is the crown prince, and put the deputy crown prince in. So I guess two questions. What's happening in terms of the politics of the Saudi royal family? And two, And by the way, the young king or the young deputy crown prince has been criticized for his oil strategy. So are they rethinking the oil strategy?
Well, this is the only strategy. This is an ailing body that needs a massive surgery. It's not a quick procedure. Too much of a good thing is a bad thing. These people, Saudi Arabia and the rest of OPEC, they have never thought for a minute to diversify their economy, to stay, to create an alternative to the oil revenue. Longer-term strategy is definitely the wrong one. The reason being, Saudi Arabia has very fast-growing population. They will continue to consume internally more than what they currently do. And as a result of that, they will have fewer and fewer barrels to export. So therefore, longer term, they will be at the mercy of higher oil prices. And that is what the current strategy is designed to do, is to basically keep oil prices at a much lower level to prevent production growth outside of OPEC, and therefore hoping that demand will balance supply, and therefore oil prices will grow, but not by the $200 and $100 and the numbers that really created the crash in oil prices. Too much of a good thing is a bad thing. Higher oil prices drove more and more investment into areas that nobody thought of before. 10, 15 years ago, nobody talked about shale production. Today, it's here to stay. 4.5 million barrels per day, that is double the production of Kuwait. So all of a sudden, Saudi Arabia realized that it's not too late to stop this train from gaining more momentum, and that's exactly what they have done. They said, in the near term, it's going to be painful, but we will be better off longer term. And I agree with this strategy. Now, if they want to change the strategy in mid-course and go back to the $100 plus oil, that is going to be really the, you know, sweet poison, if you will, because longer term is going to really hurt them pretty badly.
Well, but you've made, Fadel Gaj, you've made a good case why shale oil and the shale oil revolution and fracking are here to stay, and that they're resilient. They can handle this dumping, glutting of the market by the Saudis. And furthermore, my understanding is that the Saudis need a lot of money so that they could distribute it to their own population to keep them quiet, particularly the restive young people. And now they've had to cut subsidies on domestic oil consumption, which
they have to. They have to, like people do in their daily life. You live within your means. They obviously never thought for a minute that this cannot be sustainable. I mean, you have a society where you have huge unemployment, basically underemployment and unemployment, and subsidizing everything from, you know, the gas in your car to the water you drink, all the utilities and all these things. You know, at the end of the day, something has to give. You know, when you have oil prices going from $100 to $70, no matter how efficient and how, you know, it's going to be very difficult to make ends meet. That is why we hear rumors that Saudi Arabia is thinking seriously of spinning off part of the Aramco business, whether upstream or downstream, to generate additional source of income, because their foreign reserves have been depleted by the budget deficit, which is in tune of about $100 billion a year. So at least they are preparing for a future of low oil prices for a long period of time. That's how I read it. I read that Saudi Arabia is preparing for a long period of lower oil prices.
But you also mentioned earlier the political component here and their anger about Assad in Syria and the Russian support for Assad in Syria, and also they're deeply involved in a war in Yemen that seems more like a quagmire. And that's expensive, too. So the foreign policy aspect is also a part of the mix, isn't it?
Absolutely. But they are doing it. I mean, they are not solving any problem. It's just they're adding more fuel to the fire. They open another, you know, sinkhole, you know, in Yemen. The situation in the Middle East is getting from bad to worse. You have failed states, you have anarchists everywhere, you have ISIS threatening not only the Middle East, the rest of the world. Nothing is, you know, everything is under, you know, tremendous chaos. So there is something called diplomacy. There is something called negotiation. There is something called compromise. They have to add to their psyche that there are certain things that you cannot throw money or bomb your way out of a bad situation. So Saudi Arabia, like any other country, they will have to learn to live within their means.
Well, that apparently applies also to Venezuela, where oil is subsidized, which it's about 5 cents a gallon or something ridiculous. And that country's in economic freefall with a government that's just been elected, parliament. So go ahead. What's your
Venezuela reading? Venezuela used to have budget surplus 20 years ago when oil prices were in the low 20s. Last year, oil prices on average was 98 in 2014. Oil prices averaged over $98 per barrel, and Venezuela has its largest budget deficit in history. And that was $43 billion deficit. So don't blame it on oil prices. Blame it on corrupt and, you know, incompetent leadership that has taken the country and driving it down, you know, in a sinkhole.
Right. Well, there's a battle going on between the president, who got repudiated in the last election, where the opposition got a supermajority in the parliament. But the president, and through the courts, are paralyzing or even ignoring the parliament. And the president, Maduro, has just appointed a finance minister who doesn't believe that there's inflation happening in Venezuela, which has, the highest inflation rate in the world.
Yeah, but I mean, these people are totally disconnected from reality. They blame everything, all their ills, as a result of low oil prices. Venezuela, for years, lived with much lower oil prices, was a very prosperous country, did very well. All of a sudden, went under Hugo Chavez. Obviously, things went from bad to worse. And this fellow, the new president, or the president who has been there for the last 3 years, is obviously a lot worse than Chavez, and nothing's going to help them. They need the estimate that $120 oil in order for them to have a balanced budget. Fault did this? That has nothing to do with OPEC, has nothing to do with oil prices, has nothing to do with what's happening in China and elsewhere. It is it's just mismanagement. They got it, PDVSA, the national oil company. They took all the brain power and put them to manage supermarkets. You know, petroleum engineers lost their job or they forced to work in, you know, social program. That is basically misguided, bad, corrupt, incompetent management, and has really nothing to do with oil prices or oil economics in general.
Well, then let's turn to Russia in terms of the consequences of the glut of oil. It's clearly impacting them. I was always mystified by the extent to which Russia supported the P5+1 deal with Iran, because now Iran is desperate to catch up. They are getting an influx of money from the money that was frozen from their early sales of oil, but now they're apparently wanting to put 500,000 barrels a day on the market. What's your sense of how Russia's going to ride out this glut?
Well, it's like a chess game, and Putin proved to, have a lot more experience playing this game than anybody else. He confiscated, he occupied Crimea, and now nobody is talking about it anymore. It's part of Russia. He put the Eastern Ukraine separatist movement as a smokescreen so he can, consolidate his holding in Crimea, and obviously he is joining the coalition that negotiated with the Iranian. But the fact of the matter, at the end of the day, it's every man is for himself. The Iranian government is under tremendous pressure. It is not a democratically elected government. It is despised by their own people. Do you know that? I mean, like the rest of the Middle East, anyway. So at the end of the day, the Iranians are going to finally see that being civilized and do the right thing will be rewarding. And that's what happened in the negotiation and the settlement and lifting the economic sanction. The people of Iran, they will be a lot better, you know, this year than they were last year or 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. So they are, I think, on the right track, and they are not going to, compromise their own people. So they will do whatever is better for Iran. And if it's higher or increased petroleum export is going to be in their advantage, they will do that. Now, I don't believe that they are capable of flooding the market as we hear in the newspaper. For all practical purposes, they have been selling oil for the last 35 years, but they are not producing enough oil in excess of their domestic need. So therefore, they know that they are not, there is no hope in the near term for higher oil prices. So they are going to slug it out with the Saudis and everybody else to maintain or at least gain some market share. And that in itself is going to put a lid on how high oil prices will recover if we see a recovery in the next few months. Having said that, the $28, $27, or $30, or even $40, in my view, is that this price is not sustainable. It is too low to attract additional needed investment in the oil industry, not to grow production, but to maintain production. You need tens of billions of dollars every year by the oil industry, let alone the government of OPEC and elsewhere, to be able to maintain production at the current level. So we're probably going to see a new normal in the next 2 to 3 years. It's going to be very painful, but eventually oil prices will rise. They're not going to go to $100, but they're not going to stay at $30 either. In my view, the new normal is going to be between $60 and $70, and that is really where oil prices should have been in the last 5 or 10 years. We didn't need in 2008 financial crisis and speculation to put oil prices close to $150, and only 6 months later, oil prices back to $30. The same situation here. After the Arab Spring, all of a sudden oil prices went from $60 to $120. And before you know it, when everybody said the bottom for oil prices going forward is going to be $90, surprise, surprise, oil prices now are below $30.
Well, we know that speculators love these wild and wide swings, don't they? That's how they make their money.
They create it. They actually create it. Yeah.
Exactly. So just in closing, though, you have basically painted a picture of most of the world in terrible trouble and the United States basically in the catbird seat, sitting pretty. So what the hell's going on with the market? Why are they in such a panic?
Well, again, live by the sword or die by the sword. Everybody was spinning all the hopes on China. China is going to take care of everybody in the world. You could do, you know, people do the silly math. We say if every Chinese family owns a car, we have, you know, oil crisis in 2 years or 5 years or 10 years. It doesn't work this way. I mean, the law of large number. I mean, you just cannot extrapolate by saying that China will have to have another 200 million people coming into the workforce in the next X number of years, and these people will need apartments and shoes and everything else, and all of a sudden the economy has to grow by 10 or 11%. The Chinese economy is growing very fast, very strong, and very well. 6.9% GDP growth is double or triple the world average. So it's exaggerated. Everything is exaggerated. Wall Street is exaggerated. The speculators are still in control. No matter what the government is saying, the speculators are not the large oil company, not the small oil company, not the frackers, not the oil service company. It's that the people on Wall Street sitting behind this, you know, looking at the computer screen and really doing a lot of damage to the economy.
Well, Fidel Guide, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Fidel Guyte, who's the Managing Director for Oil and Gas Research with Oppenheimer & Company in New York City. Mr. Guyte has more than 36 years of experience in oil and gas research and has previously been with Mobil Oil and J.P. Morgan Company in New York. He's one of the most quoted analysts on energy issues and has testified before the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives about oil price speculation. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking at the reappearance of Sarah Palin on the political stage alongside her fellow reality TV star.
Energy is becoming one of our country's greatest concerns. If we don't start working on energy conservation, there may not be enough energy to go around by the time I'm a parent. We've already talked about how we can solve some of our problems through alternative energy sources. You can learn more about energy, too. Call your county cooperative extension service for more information. Conserving energy is everyone's responsibility. Call 4-H to find out how you can do your part.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way of saying goodbye. Everything I know about taking other people for a ride. And I just wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Adele Stan, who's a journalist based in Washington, D.C. She specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics and is currently a weekly columnist for The American Prospect. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adele Stan.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And Adele, we've spoken over the years, and you've been covering Sarah Palin over the years, at least since she emerged on the scene in 2008. And she spoke yesterday beside Donald Trump, endorsing him, much to the chagrin of Ted Cruz, who tried to brush it off as not a big deal. But I think most people see it as a big deal. I think Trump certainly does. And today, again, she's appeared with Donald Trump at Oral Roberts University in Oklahoma, speaking to an evangelical crowd, as indeed Donald Trump himself was speaking just a day or so ago at Liberty University to a similar group of young Christians. In this case, they were absolutely enraptured by her speech. And the biggest applause line was when Sarah Palin said, "We need a new commander-in-chief." She spoke on behalf of the veterans and the people in the military. I don't know what authority she feels she has, but she did speak on their behalf and said, "We don't really have a commander-in-chief. We have somebody that's basically selling out our boys and girls in uniform. But Donald Trump as commander-in-chief will kick ISIS's ass." And there was a huge eruption of cheers. And frankly, I'm scared to death. I mean, this is like America's version of the Nuremberg rally, for God's sake.
Well, you know, I think it's wise to be frightened, Ian. I hate to, you know, I hate to say that, because you would think that, you know, that Trump is such a buffoon and that he wouldn't have a prayer, right? But that's not true. He really does have a chance, and he has a very good chance at winning the Republican nomination. He could even win on the first ballot at the convention. It's really an astonishing development in the course of American history, I think. And the pairing of Trump and Palin, I mean, you have two reality stars. Reality show stars right there, right? I mean, this is, you know, and it speaks to this notion that, well, if you just, like, talk tough, right? I mean, they're the mean team, right? That's what they are. They're the mean team, right? If you just say mean stuff about people you don't like, you're going to win. You might win you an election, but I don't know that's going to help you win against ISIS. You know, I don't know that it's going to, you know, make America a man again, I think is really where they're headed with their messaging. I just, you know, and the fact that Trump is so, the hypocrisy in this is that, you know, these right-wing folks like to paint themselves as the real constitutionalists, and he's so extra constitutional, right? He doesn't seem to have much affection for the United States Constitution. He just believes in Donald Trump, and if I want it, it must be right. So he's a true authoritarian.
Well, but you mentioned, Adele Stan, that he is smart, and he's, you know, I think you used the word buffoon, but then also added that he's very clever. And,
he's very savvy.
Yeah, and there's nothing more savvy in his strategy. And I'm sure it's going to work. I would guess now that he's probably going to beat Cruz in Iowa. Cruz was counting on the Christian evangelical vote.
Right.
And he was ahead. And the fact that Trump went to Liberty University and is now at Oral Roberts University, that's hardly an accident. I mean, he's peeling these people off.
Yes, he is. And the thing is, with his stint at his speech at Liberty that was really striking, Ian, is that he got something just shy of an endorsement from Jerry Falwell Jr., the son of the founder of Liberty University. And, you know, Trump is not—he's not an evangelical Christian. He's thrice married. He uses swear words. I mean, he's—you know—everything that is supposed to be, you know, the antithesis of evangelical comportment, except for the fact that he expresses contempt for people who are neither, you know, white or not male, or, you know, or not white males. It's really quite astonishing. So that brings you to, well, what is it that they really see in him? What is it that, where are the points of commonality? And the point of commonality is really about whiteness and maleness and the celebration and elevation of those two characteristics and the worship of mammon, of money.
So in terms of the angry white men flocking to Trump's banner...
And the women who love them. Angry
well,
white men and the women who love
I
them.
I see. So that's the role of that's the role of Sarah Palin then, right?
Yes, I would say so. I would say so. And it is quite brilliant that he managed to, you know, get her endorsement. You're right. It will help him in Iowa, and it does help him with evangelicals across the country. I'm wondering what she's thinking she's getting. I can't imagine him, you know, appointing her as his running mate.
He dodged that question. He was actually asked that question.
He doesn't want to alienate her. He needs her out there on the trail for him.
Right.
But I
can't imagine that happening. But, you know, maybe she could be Secretary of State, you know.
Oh, gee, Ian. Oh, my goodness. She can see Russia from her house.
Right.
Oh, wow.
Right. Well, you know. But in terms, though, of Trump's lack of authenticity as a Christian, or, you know, he's a Presbyterian, he hardly ever went to church. The only church he ever went to was Norman Vincent Peale's church, which is as much about religion as it is about motivational, get ahead, get rich quick kind of stuff.
Right.
But at Liberty University, it was kind of amusing the way he tried to, you know, brush up his religious credentials.
Oh, Corinthians.
2 Corinthians, right.
Walk into a bar.
Right. Instead of 2 Corinthians. I mean, I don't know whether anybody noticed it. They cheered him like they just did today at Oral Roberts University. They love it. I mean, this guy is...
Well, they did notice, you know, reports, yeah. Reporters, you know, interviewed attendees afterwards, and they did notice, and they did chuckle. Mm-hmm. But they don't seem to mind the pandering. They just so admire the myth of Trump as a self-made man. Now, he may be a self-made billionaire, but he's hardly a self-made man. His father was quite successful in real estate in New York, and he had quite the privileged childhood. But they like the myth, and they like, you know, the bombastic delivery. They feel like he's just sticking it to everybody that they can't stand, everybody who they feel has done them wrong, whether it be, you know, bossy women who want to, you know, run the country, or whether it be, you know, African Americans who deign to think that they're equal to white people, or it's Mexicans fleeing violence in their home countries, whatever it is, you know, whomever it is that they feel have done them wrong and are displacing them from their rightful spot at the top of the heap. And as long as Trump keeps, you know, saying saying the awful things about all of those people, then it seems that he can do no wrong.
So what's your sense then of whether, I mean, my understanding is that Hillary's people are, I mean, a lot of reporting now that, that she's really worried about Bernie because he's
right.
doing so well. He's doubled her lead in New Hampshire. Latest poll puts him at 60 and her at 30.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, he's from Vermont next door, and it's a must-win state for him in any case, but he's got a very comfortable lead, according to the polls, and he's neck and neck with her in Iowa. But apparently she's ready to slog it out and hoping that when they get to South Carolina and other voters, not just, you know, white college kids, start voting, it'll change for them. So that's their calculus. But I understand also that they're very concerned about Trump, that they don't take him lightly. They think he's a real contender for the nomination and a real contender for the presidency. And I'm hearing that they'd much prefer to run against Cruz.
That's so fascinating because, you know, Cruz is no slouch, you know, and he's also quite dangerous. He's a very smart guy and also extremely far right. But Trump, you know, Trump doesn't have to pretend to stick to any particular principles in the way that Cruz does, right? Cruz has always defined himself as a principled constitutionalist and you know, the best little boy in church but the guy who's not afraid to throw some elbows to stand up for the right thing. You know, Trump doesn't have to stand up for the right thing. Trump hasn't declared that he has any particular principles. All Trump has to do is express the ire of a chunk of the electorate, and let us remember that the United States is run on an electoral college system. So the popular vote does not determine the outcome of a presidential election. And in Democratic states, I have high concentrations of Democrats and low concentrations of Democrats in other states. So I think that they are wise to be concerned about Trump as an opponent. Plus, he's going to have a lot of money. And he knows media very, very well. He's such a savvy player of the media. I mean, he's such a savvy player of the media, he hasn't had to spend hardly any money on it because he knows how to get lots of media for free. So, and it's in her nature to be kind of measured in her responses, cautious. So that's not really a great, he's not a great opponent for her because she doesn't feel that she can respond in kind.
So what do you think, though? My sense is that Cruz, who is probably going down in the polls, I think Palin will give Trump a bump, and and he might well beat Cruz in Iowa. But surely the fact that Cruz is clever and smart, there's no question about it, and intelligent, but deeply cynical. He will literally say anything, and he shapeshifts in a way that's just breathtaking. But he is such a phony. I mean, he tries to come across as a populist, as an anti-government, anti-big government crusader, anti-establishment. And here he is getting $1 million loan from Goldman Sachs, where his wife works, and from Citibank to get elected. I mean, literally, he was put in by the ultimate insider establishment, the people who run America, Wall Street. I mean, you can't be anti-establishment and be a creature and puppet of Wall Street.
Well, unless you're a Republican. I mean, I think that you can, because we're no longer dealing in a reality-based, you know, community, as the term goes, right? It's that, you know, anything can, on the right, as long as you're expressing the sentiment, the things that people want to believe. I mean, this is true generally of people, but it's even more so on the right. As long as you're expressing what people want to believe, whether it's about you or about their reality, about the way that they live, You can get away with this. The facts be damned. I mean, let's look at what look at climate change, and you know how these people vehemently, you know, reject the science on climate change. I mean, Cruz is top among them selling this harebrained reading of measurements of climate change, where he zeroes in on one particular figure, ignores all the others, sells it like it was snake oil, and it's bought. So, Ian, I'm really don't think that hypocrisy really matters much on that side of the aisle.
Well, but it does seem that Trump is going after him, and every time Trump's gone after anybody, it's hurt them.
Yes, that's true.
And he's doing it now, and he's bringing up this hypocrisy that I just mentioned. You know, this guy's pretending he's a populist and he's for the average person and he's against the establishment and he's a real renegade. Like, Trump has clearly cornered the market on that. And yet he's taken all this money from Wall Street.
Well, I hate to disagree with you, Ian, because I wouldn't want us to have a squirmish. But for those of you who don't know, is a word that was invented by Sarah Palin yesterday in her endorsement of Donald Trump. However, I would say that that Trump can get away with making that point and winning on that point because he's Trump, because he already has, a groundswell of support. But if a Democrat tried to make that point against Cruz, I don't think it would, it would hold water at all.
So what's your understanding, though, of the extent to which Cruz is hated? I mean, Terry Branstad, the governor of Iowa, came out in a very unusual way and said, "This guy's terrible. You can't vote for him."
That was just remarkable, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was very, very personal, and he's a popular governor. So there's something out there. You know, I've been reading stories how the Republican establishment was so alarmed at Trump, are willing to sort of hold their nose and support Cruz, even though they don't like him.
Right.
But Branstad's remarks fly in the face of that. They suggest that the hatred for him is deep and pervasive amongst Republicans.
I wish I knew. I must confess that, this year I have not been traveling to cover the race. So I don't know that for sure. And I do know that Branstad is very involved in getting investment for renewables. And of course, Iowa is a great landscape for things like wind and biofuels and things like that. And he really opposes Cruz's, shilling for the oil industry on things like climate change. So I don't know how much of his distaste is particular to that issue. However, I can tell you, in Washington, D.C., among his Senate colleagues, I mean, I don't think there's anyone who's more despised than the grandstanding Ted Cruz.
Well, just in closing, Adele Stan, what's your sense then of whether the Democrats, who have been hidden by the DNC with their debates
right,
in a way that is just breathtakingly aggravating.
Idiotic,
if you ask me. It's an insult to the American people, to American democracy. It is so counterintuitive to the candidates,
right,
who, except for the unfortunate Martin O'Malley, really do well on these debates. So there's no reason. I mean, I understand the logic of people in the bag for Hillary saying, well, let's marginalize Bernie and not give him a platform.
That's so ridiculous, though, because she does quite well debating against him.
Of course
she
does.
I mean, they both come across as, very, very good candidates. And the thinking, whoever decided, and much of it is, attributed to Debbie Wasserman Schultz, whoever decided that was brilliant, really should not be leading the Democratic National Committee.
But I saw at the end of the last debate that the NBC carried on Sunday, Debbie Wasserman Schultz was right there behind Hillary, as though she was like, carrying her bridal train. Well, Adele Stan, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Adele Stan, who's a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics, and she's currently a weekly columnist for The American Prospect. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into President Obama's visit to the Detroit Auto Show today. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dan Neal, who's the automotive columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dan Neal.
Ah, nice to be here, Ian.
And Dan, the president was visiting the Detroit Auto Show today. He's obviously touting the recovery of Detroit thanks to his administration's intervention early in his administration. But he's also looking at hybrid cars and electric cars, and going back to the big electronics show in Las Vegas, which is, you know, an odd platform for automobiles, but that seems to be where we're heading. Give us a sense of what this revolution in electric and hybrid vehicles, how real is this revolution?
Oh, it's real, and it's only a matter of time. You know, technical solutions usually yield to time and money. We've seen that over and over again. And this is a classic optimization problem for engineering. But I think that, you know, Obama's presence at the Detroit Auto Show and his reciting of the success of the bailout of the auto industry, which was started under President Bush, you know, is really important for people to realize. GM would not be around, and Chrysler would not be around had we not intervened. And more to the point, Ford might have gone down too, because Ford would relied on the same network of tier one suppliers. Ford was also very heavily leveraged during the Bear Stearns crisis, but they were leveraged with private money, not public money. You know, the Obama administration is famous for not letting a crisis go to waste. This is a classic example. When they bailed out the Detroit automakers, they made them agree to go along with new CAFE standards, made them sort of browbeat them into accepting a 54.5 MPG fleet standard by 2025, which is a hugely ambitious number. They are being held to those promises, even at a time when gas is at a historically low price. And, there's a coming disconnect. Pretty soon, consumers are going to, you know, start asking, why do I have to buy a car that gets 35 miles a gallon when gasoline is so incredibly cheap? There are forces at work now looking to decouple the bailout deal and the EPA CAFE standard from one another, so that they want to backtrack on that big 54.5 MPG number. That, I think, is a reason to be concerned and a reason for Obama to show up at the Detroit Auto Show and sort of shore up that raison d'etre.
So what the president has on his side in terms of arguing that people should switch to electric and hybrid surely is the fact that today we just learned from NOAA that 2014 was the hottest year on record in human history. And we know that global warming is real, at least most of the world does, except for a few politicians in this country. So can he make that argument, or are people simply just thinking, well, you know, with gas...
Oh, no. I speak to a fairly skeptical audience along these lines, and resistance is giving way left and right. People are beginning to realize that they've been had. And, you know, when you look at all the Koch money that is poured into the messaging around the petrochemical and coal and gas industries, it's a miracle that that people have come to their senses. But reports like the one you refer to, you know, it used to be an argument on the basis of authority. Whose authority did you believe? But now people can look out their window and believe their own eyes. And I believe year after year, that begins to soak some common sense and perhaps even trigger a survival instinct in people who previously might have been skeptical. And that's the other thing, too. I mean, I feel like the tribalism that is around global warming, and indeed this is a very, very germane to the auto industry, you know, I feel like that tribalism is giving way. I think there are a lot of people who see that you don't have to make a choice. It is a false choice between, you know, personal mobility and clean mobility. Can be done. It will be done. The rest of the world is going to do it without us. So if we want to sell cars around the world, then we're going to have to do it too.
So did you go to the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas?
Well, the great thing about the great thing about the CES is it's a virtual reality. It's a virtual reality you can enjoy from a distance. And that's where how I like to keep Las Vegas, at a distance. but I am familiar. Like, I'm on my way to Detroit right now to see GM's, you know, virtualization cockpit, their autonomous program. You know, it doesn't really make sense to have autonomous cars that run on petroleum, because autonomy means that cars can charge themselves without inconveniencing their owners or clients in the case of shared mobility. So CES, you said, is, you know, it's an odd place to bring up automobiles. That is the heart and soul of the next 10 years of the auto business. It is going to be a radically different business. And along with it, it's going to be a much cleaner product.
Well, the fact that Apple's getting into the mix, I mean, and Tesla has proven that you don't have to be in Detroit to make cars, right?
No, in fact, every car maker I know has a pretty big base camp in Silicon Valley, including General Motors, Mercedes-Benz. Everybody has research and development facilities in Silicon Valley. They are all pursuing autonomy as a very near-term probability. And if they don't have it ready, then they're going to lose in the market. That is, everyone is convinced of this. I'm surprised, actually, the sudden embrace. Just in the past 6 months, the mood among the technical community in the automotive industry has changed. And there is an embrace of these new technologies and sort of a through line being seen. You know, people are going to now understand how they might make this work for them as an industry, as a civilization, you know, and it's a great time to be covering automobiles.
Well, in terms of the president's visit to the Detroit Auto Show, he checked out the new Fiat Chrysler Pacifica minivan, which is a plug-in hybrid, and said, "This is cool." And then he talked about Get Shorty, nice the movie, which is very strange. And then he checked out.
What do you mean, talking Get Shorty with the Oldsmobile silhouette? He name checked Get Shorty.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. That guy is the coolest president ever.
Yeah, it's cool. He said it's cool driving a minivan. And then he checked out the 27 Chevy Bolt as well as a bright yellow Corvette. But then he got into this metallic orange Bolt and very much enjoyed that. So he's doing what he can to get people to move to electric and hybrid. It seems like everybody, though, is doing it in terms of the automotive world.
Yeah, the only people who aren't doing it are the consumers, and this is the big challenge. You know, when will the consumers come along? And my argument is you don't have to ask. You have to tell the consumers. At some point, we're going to have to outlaw gasoline. It's just, as you mentioned, you know, there's these forces marshaling to combat global climate change, and the automobile and light-duty personal transportation is a big problem with that. It's about 30%. 30% of carbon emissions are mobile in the world. So gasoline is going to go away. And this is the thing. When will the consumers get on board? One thing is happening, as you may have read in the USA Today today, they had their banner headline was that younger people are not getting their driver's license anymore, down to 75% of young adults who have driver's licenses, plummeting since the 1990s. The connection with the automobile with young people is broken. And so you ask where the, you know, if you ask where the customers are going to come from, they're going to be much younger, and they're going to be much less enamored of owning and much more interested in renting or borrowing or micro-leasing or some sort of temporary low-overhead kind of relationship with the automobile they don't have now.
But what about the role of mandates, which we've had here in California, which has changed the nature of automobiles? And there was recently an article I read about how the government in Norway has given enormous subsidies to buy Teslas. So if when you say, you know, at the end of the day, we have to outlaw gasoline, would an interim step be some kind of, I mean, I know they do have discounts and subsidies, but can they be increased?
Oh yeah, sure. And on the other side of it, just in terms of the black box we call the battery inside some of these vehicles, those black boxes have gotten much cheaper, and so they're in effect they are discounting. And now batteries are such that Moore's law doesn't exactly apply, but the whole technology is becoming much cheaper, and the big change in the cost of the technology, with the affordability, the approachability, the acceptability of it all, is the gigafactory that Tesla is building, which will, by some estimates, lower the unit cost of lithium-ion batteries by 30% from where it is now. So that is a huge knot. This is gonna, and I'm just on my way to Detroit to drive the Bolt, which is a $30,000, 200-mile range electric car. Which was, those two figures have been kind of, you know, magic bogeys, but they couldn't be achieved, but they have been achieved, and General Motors is doing it. So it's you know, in many respects, it's a signal achievement for a company that would have been dead but for the federal intervention.
Since you brought up Moore's law, why won't there be a breakthrough in batteries, though?
You mean as opposed to semiconductor efficiency?
Well, yeah, you said that the Moore's law doesn't apply to batteries, to the black box,
right.
But surely there's still a possibility there could be a breakthrough.
Yes, the electrochemical storage is at this point pretty well understood with the kind of chemistry that one could put safely on an automobile. In the 1900s, people thought there was all the chemistry that there was to discover had been discovered, so one hesitates. But batteries, because they're physical items, they're a particular kind of energy storage device, doesn't yield to Moore's law like a semiconductor. It certainly could. The price breakthrough is what really matters, not so much the efficiency, because, like, for example, the Bolt can go 200 miles a day. I'm not going to drive some crazy little car 200 miles. That's way more range than I need. But cost, which is the sort of inverse slope of range, is an issue for me. And so I'd rather have lower cost if I could get it.
Sure. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Dan Neal. I really appreciate it.
I'm a pleasure to talk to you, and we'll talk to you again.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Cheers. And again, I've been speaking with Dan Neal, who is the automotive columnist for The Wall Street Journal, and previously he was the automotive columnist for The Los Angeles Times. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.